Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Josh Brown, I'm still so sad. So,
why? England
so
won
sad.
Last night, Scottsdale. You should have nothing to be sad about.
England won, but video games lost. Callisto Protocol is one of the most disappointing games of the year, and it is just genuinely tragic and sad. We did a whole news video on it because I just wanted to do something called Callisto Protocol as a tragic disappointment. Because it's one of those games, and again, we'll talk about a whole bunch of stuff. This is the wind-up. This is the podcast. I'm Scott Tilford. You're Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Where we dive into the latest video games, the latest talking points in the industry. And one of the biggest talking points in the industry is what an absolute fire this game is.
And I have to apologize because I feel that this is my fault. I am so sorry because I jinxed this game a few weeks ago. We were talking, Scott, about this year's kind of wind down period in comparison to this time last year or the year before. And we were saying, you know, it's missing a Cyberpunk. It's missing a Grand Theft Auto Definitive Edition. Why don't we have anything that's come out that's sort of been disastrous that we can talk about? Yeah. And then Callisto came out and it was not the one I was expecting to be a disaster, but it seems like it has disappointed many people, including yourself, which sucks to hear specifically because I know how much you've been excited about this game fall. That's not a sentence, but you know what I mean.
No, at the start of this year, or near the first few months of this year, obviously we had Callisto Protocol, we had Horizon Forbidden West, we had all these different games that were coming out, and it was like, oh my God, nothing's going to be able to beat these titles. And I just had a feeling for Callisto Protocol. I thought it was just, it looked so mechanically tight. It had, you know, Glenn Schofield do this in Dead Space, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare. His next game, it's like a Death Stranding thing. It's like blank check, do whatever you want. What the hell is this guy going to come up with? And I just thought Callisto looked so promising. Like, it just had everything going for it. Like, obviously, graphically, immediately stunning. Dude's got a blank check kind of thing, or that kind of general approach to it. And it just, how do you get this wrong? How could you possibly get this wrong? And I had such a feeling when there was no review codes, there was nothing at all. And I'd bought it early. I ended up buying it on, like, Wednesday, hoping it would turn up early and everything. But it's just that general, that gut feeling we always have when reviews aren't plentiful, when hands-on time isn't plentiful. And just, this is why, because the core mechanics, the core dodge system, the core feel of the game is just abysmal.
Well, that's it. You said, you know, how do they get this wrong? How did they get this wrong, Scott Telford? We talked on the news video about the combat and how they've kind of botched that in terms of, you know, it being far too punishing, far too cheap, in your words, far too legitimately broken.
I'm saying it's right now it's legitimately broken.
And I've seen that echoed online as well, you know?
It needs invincibility frames for the character after doing a dodge because you successfully dodge and then die anyway because part of the enemy's like hitbox is still registering with you, which sometimes triggers an instant kill animation. So it's still just, that's all that's wrong with it, quote unquote. But
well, if that's all that's wrong with
them,
it, I want to ask you a few questions. I want to talk about the rest of the game because I've seen so much discourse online, naturally, over the weekend about the combat system, its shortcomings, how dull it is to play, how frustrating it can be to play. Mm-hmm. But as a successor to Dead Space in terms of its storytelling and characters and environments and monster designs and death designs, like, is that stuff
it's nothing like that? It's nothing like that.
Oh no.
It's if that's the comparison point, which obviously it is, one of the only things that really carries over is the new dude, Jacob, or whatever the hell he's called, does the same weird hunch standing animation that Isaac does, where they're constantly hunching everywhere.
Very me then.
Yeah, it's just like as much as, cause the thing is, I like that it's differentiable. I like that it doesn't feel like Dead Space overall. Obviously, you can see this game was made by the creator of Dead Space, but it doesn't, like, you don't have the level of lore. Like, there's more lore in the podcast in terms of, like, the prequel podcast, in terms of how the game actually opens up or anything. And they just sort of, they just rattle through their premise in about 5 minutes. And it's just sort of like, right, the prison's been taken over. Right, okay, here's your stun baton. Right, go. And it's just like, okay, what's happening? What's infecting the prison? Who am I going up against? Why is Sam Witwer here? Like, what's going on?
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned the game, the suffering earlier on as a comparison thing. And like you said, obviously this prison being overrun by this spooky force or whatever it is. And that sounds really good. And when I talk about, you know, it being a spiritual successor to Dead Space, I definitely don't even want it to be ripping Dead Space off a lot of the times. I don't want it to be a one-to-one comparison, more taking the ethos of that game's design and kind of expanding it out, adding new twists to certain things and putting your own stamp on it is kind of what I mean by that. Does it not?
The stomp carries across.
Literal stomp.
It has put his own stamp on it.
Well, there you go. Apart from the literal stomp, like, does the world itself, you're talking there about it, not making that much of a first impression in terms of its narrative or lore? Like, does it have a world that you want to see explored more when they fix the combat? Is it something you're excited to go back to, or is it more an obligation?
It's a strange one. I'm only talking about this through the lens of how does it compare to Dead Space, because in Dead Space you had the whole thing about planets being broken open and look at this mining company, and then you're arriving on you find the Ishimura and all that kind of stuff. In this, for me, like I said, there's more lore in the prequel podcast, because they're talking about in this future there's this place called the FSA, which is the failed state of America, where we're just going off the idea that America has failed going forward completely, and now we're all taken to the stars to become these different, and there's all these different terminologies. Being a skip tracer is like someone who's like FTL travel kind of thing and getting around the galaxy. None of that is in the start of the game. Maybe it gets there eventually, but overall, it doesn't hit you with as much upfront stuff in the way that Dead Space did. So it kind of feels like maybe it'll get there, but it's like, it's so streamlined. It's just like, you're a dude, here's some combat mechanics, the prison's being taken over, but it's all presented so absolutely gorgeously. Like, it looks incredible. And like, it reminds me of The Suffering just because it is the idea of a prison being taken over by something.
Yeah.
And all the prisoners freaking out and people being attacked in their cells and whatever. That's a great setup, especially for a space horror prison planet game. But then immediately you're funneled into corridors and quite simplistic spaces and lots of shimmying load screens. But my main issue with it is the combat, is just how broken the combat feels, because I don't mind a straightforward linear game. Like, I mean, I love the whole 360 era. Mm-hmm. Evil West is doing very well just like that right now. But yeah, I think that it's like, if you're coming to it for that immediate feel that Dead Space had, where it's like, this is a whole world. I think Glenn Schofield and the team have thought of those things, but they don't front load them here.
Right. That's fascinating, especially with Dead Space, the remake, literally just around. Just
I should flag that I'm still very ill.
Hello.
And oh my God, my throat. Carry on.
You're a trooper. You're doing your best.
I'm trying, but my throat does not want to let me.
Just with Dead Space right around the corner, you know, I'm going to be playing both of those games in January, and I fear that Callisto won't fare well in the shadow of that game or with that right around the corner. I don't know. I want to ask you more about like this year in general, because we've talked on the podcast and in news and in lists for the past few months about how good this year has been. There have been
unbelievable.
So many unbelievable highs.
Stray is not one of them, carry on.
However, in between those unbelievable highs, I think the perception of that people have about it being a disappointing year or maybe an underwhelming year is because a lot of the big games have underwhelmed. Like, I'm writing right now the 10 most disappointing games of 2022.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be a little bit of a struggle. You know, I might have to pull in remasters or remakes that didn't quite hit the bar to kind of, you know, be like, flesh it out amongst the AAA games. Whereas this year, it's immediately, you know, Callisto. It's immediately Gotham Knights. For me, it's immediately Dying Light 2. Big AAA games.
God, Dying Light 2.
That weren't disasters by any means. Aren't even terrible games by any means in a lot of cases. But certainly were not where they needed to be and not where people expected them to be.
There was something I was going to talk about before my throat attack, and I had to go and get some water. But there's a specific feeling that we get in gaming where you're looking forward to something, you get it, maybe the reviews aren't out there. That's what I was going to get to when I was talking about review coverage, just planting that seed of like, maybe something's up with this. And then when the reviews broke and GameSpot gave it 5 out of 10, and I saw SkillUp's review just saying, I don't recommend this. And I was like, oh my God, how can you not recommend this at all? And obviously you watch the review and he does say the thing that tipped him over was the combat. But there's something unique to gaming, this unique tragic feeling of, it's like your entry cost is really high, like the unit cost is really high. Callisto is not a full priced product in terms of being £70 or $70. It's 40. I got it for 45. It seems like it averages about 45 to 50. But there's a unique feeling in gaming where it's like you've coughed up the money, you've been looking forward to this thing, the hype cycle's sky high, you've been very much manufactured and massaged in a certain way, in a way that no other medium really does, with holding the review coverage or withholding what the game really is, and just by de facto of like, what build of the game are we getting? Like, there's all that weird stuff. And then just sitting there with it going like, this isn't satisfying, but I've paid the money and everything else is nailing it. Like, graphical presentation, everything is so perfect. I just want to love you. And it's like, I had that with Pokemon. It's like, can you just fix the frame rate? Like, can you just make it playable? Like, because Why are you getting these basic things wrong? And I know why. I get the I know the developer crunch, the reality of making something this complex.
Yeah.
But it's just, it is just sad because of that. Because, like, it's a new team, Glenn Schofield's first thing since Dead Space in that vein. And to get something so fundamental as invincibility frames or enemy awareness icons so that you can't just get chip damaged from someone across the room that you couldn't even see. Things like that, to get them wrong is just tragic and sad on a on a production level. Like, yeah. You guys have put so much time and effort into this for it to stumble and faceplant at the very end.
Like you said, it's a shame, you know, yeah. And I think a lot of people, myself included, you know, I'm like I said, I'm saving the game for January to play it in the new year, but that wasn't even influenced by review scores or anything. But those review scores that I saw coming in, like, they were surprising, you know. Yeah. I wasn't on the same level of hype as you, where I was thinking it was going to be a Game of the Year contender, but I was expecting, you know, at the lowest, for it to get 7 out of 10s, it to be an enjoyable old school romp. So to see those fives, to see those basic fundamentals, in my opinion, that they seem to have gotten wrong, like, that is a shame. It does make you think, you know, well, what happened? You know, there were just reports.
I think
it's
just a shit time thing. Yeah.
But there were reports last week of them having help from PlayStation's visual arts team. You know, they've got, they are a smallish developer, but they've got, according to this report, 150 developers from Sony to help them finish the game. It's like, yes, it's a smaller game, but it's had a lot of, there's a lot of resources there. And I don't know, I just want to, I'm interested in the behind the scenes machinations of this game's production.
That is absolutely the far and away positive. It's like the facial animation is next level. Like, there's so many parts of it that just feel next gen and immediately feel next gen. It's like, okay, this is what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for something to knock me out this immediately, for a new IP as well. It's like, can something come out of nowhere and look so complete? But yeah, it's still that feeling of, like, just base time spent. Like, and way more QA testers might have caught the invincibility frame stuff, or would have, even this, like, you know, listening to audio logs, like, you can pause the game whilst an audio log is on and then unpause, and then you're allowed to walk around whilst listening to it. And the fact that checkpoints put you, like, back, even if you manually save, they still put you back to whatever the last autosave checkpoint was, which is maybe before you've done a bunch of, like, upgrades or whatever. So it's like, you got to do all that stuff all over again. So things like that are just, like, raw testing time that just wasn't put in at the very end. But it does look absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Which is why it's just so annoying. Or, like, just, it is just sad. I'm just, I'm not, like, angry. I'm just disappointed.
Well, here's my final question. And to steal Skillup's entire framing device and thumbnail convention, like, I think I know the answer, but do you recommend this at all? Like, is it good in spite of its flaws? Will people get something out of it if they can trudge through with the combat? Like, is there enough there to recommend it now? Or is it a case of the combat is so fundamentally wonky that it brings everything else down?
Right,
it isn't
now,
worth slogging through.
Yeah, right now, I mean, I've given up on it. Like, right now, there was one encounter that I did about 20 times last night just trying to get through it. But at some point, you are just being hit from across the room for things you can't see. You can't, the dodge does not work. It is not reliable. Even if your animation plays out and you dodge, you'll still take damage sometimes. But there's no rhyme or reason to it. It is just broken. Like, it does just need fixing. So, and it sucks. Like, I mean, I keep trying to play it. Because again, it's like that Let Me Love You thing. I'm like, I love the look of this. And I can go for quite a threadbare story. Like, I can go for what they're serving up in that regard. And it, like I said, it's so atmospheric in terms of the lighting effects, and the gore effects are incredible and everything. And the thing is, like, I'll end by saying, like, it has such a potential, at the core of it. Because I did see our own Dan Durkin, who was on the podcast last week, put a video up just saying, like, look, if you're listening entirely to the negative reviews, you're playing yourself, because look at how incredible this combat can be. And there are pockets where it works. Like, because because shooting a gun works as a stun lock, you can break the enemies out of their attack cycle to keep stunning them and then wade in with your attacks. They'll sometimes do the same to you, which is what feels like the broken part, because they'll just tank the hit sometimes. One of your melee attacks will just tank that and hit you instead. But you can kind of come at a bunch of enemies what's that song? Like a rainbow?
What?
Like a rainbow. What's that song?
I don't know what that song is.
I've drunk too much water. What's that name of that song? There's I'm sure it was like a wrecking ball. What's
like a wrecking ball.
Is that
you
Katy
hit me
Perry?
Like a wrecking ball, blah, blah, blah. Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, Miley Cyrus. That you can come at them like a wrecking ball and very much take a lot of people out if you nail everything just right. But it's luck based, it's not skill based, because that's just the AI not doing the thing that it might do any other time and take you out again. In theory, you can do things like, you know, wound enemies, do a big charge attack, send them flying across the room. Maybe they go into like some part of the environment that's mechanized and it chews them up and you get a really insane gory kill or something. You know, and then because you've pre-baked holding down one of the directions to do a dodge, the next dude that runs at you, you immediately step to the side and you take that guy out really fast as well. If you nail some of the timing on that stuff, or just, you know, you make sure you're in the right place at the right time, you will get different parts of the HUD that'll show you, okay, a weak spot opened up on this creature.
Yeah.
So if you aim right now, you'll nail a headshot. All that stuff, again, so much potential. That's great. When those things line up, it makes you sit there and go, okay, it must be me. I must be missing something. Sheer consensus over time, sheer amount of times it happens to you. And I put a clip on Twitter. It's in the video that we just did, and the audio will be on here as well. At some point, it is just broken, because then the next time you go, well, that felt great, I'll go do that again. You go to dodge, you die. And it's like, what? Like,
yeah.
Can I enjoy this or not? Like, just, and that side of it only compounds the tragic side of it, where it's like, you guys are so close, so, so close. If God of War Ragnarok had the same issues, it would be getting talked about the same way.
Right.
Because it would just be a colossal disappointment, because they wouldn't have enemy awareness meters, or the dodge wouldn't work, or you couldn't block, or whatever.
I have a suspicion with this one, Scott, yes. and we won't know until I play it in a month or 3 weeks or whenever January comes around. Yeah. I worry, and I think this might be a classic wind-up example of me ending up liking something, because I don't know, obviously, from first-hand experience how bad this combat is, but I have seen good reviews out there. Like you said, Dan Durkin, who says that there is something, if you can put up with this broken stuff, there's something there to love, and I wonder whether we end up with a situation where you're like, this is broken, and I'm like, it's not that bad, but we'll see. It's not invalidating what you just said. I'm just, I can almost see the writing on the wall of coming back to this podcast and
me being, the thing,
Scott,
right?
I love this video game.
That's the big variable, is how much is intentional on their part? Do they want you to have invincibility frames if you dodge? Do they still want the enemy to be able to tag you even if you successfully dodge? Is that a thing that they think artistically is contributing to a sense of fear and a sense of foreboding and a sense of you could still die at any time? Do they want you to luck your way through these experiences, like, and these combat encounters? Maybe. It doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel intentional. It feels broken. Especially when parts of the environment can take an enemy out and you'll still get the canned animation of them killing you. So things like that, they just need to be polished. Then you've still got, like I said, stuff like the checkpointing system and the health system. Little things like that. Some stuff I get is intentional. Some stuff feels like it's so close to the finish line and not there. I've mentioned on the video, but I watched Maximilian Dude, who's like a big streamer, compare it to Resident Evil 4. Because in his chat, they were like, well, what does this do wrong when games like Resident Evil 4 have hordes of enemies coming at you? And he was directly comparing them and talking about how there's invincibility frames in there and how, like, the way that the AI doesn't bum rush you, like, you're not getting hit off camera very often. And usually you know something's coming at you. So all these little things that need to be put in there, if that's the combat model that you're going for. It's in a fascinating place because I'm rooting for it. Like, I think that every other part of its rollout has been masterful, like genuinely masterful. Like, there's a real feeling of a veteran absolutely nailing it, like, across the board. And I'm not like a massive fan of Glenn Schofield's like that much, but I know his work, and like watching him appear on, he did like a Wired interview. There was the Prequel podcast. He's been out there very vocal on Twitter. Like, you know, he was very ex-Dead Space. He was very FEA as well, which people were like, yeah, go you. Like, every bit of it has been perfect until right now. And it's just like, oh my God, you fell at the very end. So I'm rooting for them to bring it back.
What a shame, man. And again, I can only apologize, because in the podcast we did last Wednesday, or I guess last Thursday, we were talking about, you know, this weekend being packed with games, having Callisto, having Midnight Suns, having Need for Speed Unbound. Mm-hmm. And we all said, me, James Dowse, and Dan Durkin, Callisto will be fine. That's the one that's a sure fire bet. That'll be all right. It'll be one of the others that tanks or is disappointing.
No, I should say that if you told me months ago that the card-based Marvel game versus the sort of risky art aesthetic, or whatever you want to call it, of Need for Speed. I always loved the look of Unbound, but a lot of people were like, oh my God, it's all cel-shaded, what the hell is this? Versus the next game from the Dead Space guy that they would roll out in opposite orders in terms of where I put Callisto at the bottom of those three. I've been lucky enough to be able to afford to play all three of them since Friday, and Callisto is the one that is by far the worst one.
Yeah.
But it's the one that has the most ground to cover and the easiest ground to cover.
You were talking about there it being inverted in terms of the ones that you liked the most. Mm. What is the one that you've liked the most out of those three games that came out on Friday?
It's definitely Need for Speed, but it's followed very closely by Midnight Suns. Midnight Suns is a game that I was playing going, I hope this doesn't flop. I hope this doesn't fail, because it's Midnight. I started talking Need for Speed and I talked about Midnight Suns. I'll get to Midnight Suns. Need for Speed is just such a beautiful, confident arcade racing game. The kind of design that people like me have wanted in a racing game for so long. Because this is Criterion, so it's there's a lot of Burnout Paradise in this, like in terms of the overall like world design, the map design, and it's just so immediate. Like if you like Burnout Paradise and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Okay.
It's if you just mesh them together, that's this game.
I didn't even realize that it was open world until I was reading some of the like first impressions after the fact. Like that completely passed me by for whatever reason.
No, they do a really cool thing with this is a really weird thing to say. There's grind in this, but in a way that kind of works because like certain races, you need to have buy-in. So it's like if you're spending all your money upgrading your car or you're spending all your money on absolute drip up the wazoo, because there's so much drip in this game. I'm probably using the term incorrectly, but there's so many clothing items, so many cosmetic items, so many different ways that you can create wraps and decals and stuff for your car. You can absolutely get lost in that side of it if you want to. And I really love the character creator and the car customization as well. And it has the Forza style thing where it's like community created liveries or liveries.
Yeah.
And you can just bring them back in. So if someone's made like a really cool looking anime design, you just paste it right onto your car. It doesn't cost you anything. But yeah, in terms of the actual race progression, you have this whole thing where it's just sort of like you can actually either spend your money on the buy-in. Some of them are free, but then it's like you might have to grind out one of the free-to-enter races to get enough money to do one of the buy-in races to get more money. And then when you're back in the open world, the cops are now onto you because street racing is like illegal in this lakeshore place, which is the name of the city. And so it's like, okay, can you actually get back to the your garage to bank all the money that you have? Or should you stay out longer and do more races and raise the heat? And then you'll have like up to like a five, it's like five flame icons where different types of cars come after you. But if you get busted, you lose everything.
Nice. So that's a cool really little cool risk reward gimmick to the gameplay there. You were I think was it you who put on Twitter? Someone put on Twitter like some screenshots from the game talking about how gorgeous it looks.
Yeah, it's insane.
And how does that stack up? Because obviously a lot of the focus has been on the kind of street aesthetics, you know, the kind of graffiti, the kind of like more stylized flair of it. But like in terms of the cars and the presentation, the photorealism of it, that looks like really impressive as well. Is it a next-gen only game?
Yes.
Am I making that up? Okay.
No, it's next-gen only, so that does mean it's on Series S, but yeah, Series S, Series X, and PS5. So all the characters are cel-shaded. The thing is, I wish they went further with the cel-shading in the cars and the environments, because I feel like when they initially showed it off, it felt like the whole world was kind of like that. And then it's like, when you get there for the real game, it's the characters are entirely cel-shaded, and then you've still got like realistic looking cars. They definitely have like an effect on them, but it's not as like, you know, it's not rendered the same way like a Forza or a Gran Turismo is. But I kind of wish they went further. Like, for the 7 people who are listening to this who played Automodelista on the PS2, that's what I wanted this to look like. And so there is that side of it where it's kind of like mixed in terms of like you have anime characters or cel-shaded looking characters in like a realistic world. I think it works well enough. And the cars have loads of things coming off them. That's what makes me think of Spider-Verse. Like, there's lots of little doodles coming off them, lots of little, you know, like effects that come off the tires when you screech. There's loads of smoke when you're doing drift. That's all cel-shaded as well.
Nice.
So there is this sort of general idea that like a sketch artist just went crazy over a Need for Speed game and like various fonts are laid on top of each other and that side of it I think gives it so much life. Like it made me think of SSX Tricky and it's like, honestly, this is the first EA big game in a decade or something. Like whenever the EA big label stopped, this has EA big all over it. Like it's just like the way that all the different transitions work, all the different ways all the icons animate, and the way that just the soundtrack is like lockstep with the overall presentation of it. There's such a vibe to the whole game that is like, they used to just knock that out of the park back in the day, like the SSX series, Freak Style, whatever, Def Jam. Like this is very Def Jam. Which is something that I absolutely love, and I think that it permeates like the feel of the racing as well. It's very arcadey, lots of nitrous, lots of like you can either tap nitrous to bank like or to use one of the 3 segments to just like boost ahead, or you can hold it and do like a more considered thing. And so that's a really cool idea as well. You can sideswipe dudes off the road, but it doesn't do the takedown cam burnout style, but you are like rewarded for like knocking people away. And there's loads of dialogue between the races because you'll just sideswipe someone and you'll hear them in the distance. Just go, oh, so it's like that? And they'll try and get back. And it's like you get rivals, you can place bets on who you think you'll be able to beat. Just all that stuff is just so confident. It's great. Like it's such a great arcade racing game with like enough simulation stuff, enough tweaking, enough that kind of thing.
This game is being done dirty if it's this good, because I feel like EA has buried it completely. You know, it came out on the day of Callisto Protocol. It came out on the day of Midnight Suns after only being announced a few months ago, and there were no reviews at launch that I was aware of. You know, it just feels like it's come out, and as a result, I was reading online earlier, I think it was a Games Industry Biz article reporting that it had sold like 63% less than Need for Speed
Heat,
and it's just a shame if the game is of this quality. Like, why is EA doing this to certain franchises? Where they just pump them out and letting them die.
They had like a weird thing with this where they had the Palace Edition where you would spend like it was like 10 or 20 pounds more or dollars more to access the game a few days early. So like lots of people started getting Unbound on Wednesday and then waiting for the actual reviews on Friday. But like the way they split that, just like, yeah, why? Like, you know, let people get out there and see how good it is. Because yeah, hands down, like I said, this feels really EA big. But this is like the best arcade racer since Burnout Paradise. And I don't even rate Paradise that much personally. I prefer Takedown or whatever.
Me too.
But if you grew up on Need for Speed Underground or just Need for Speed games in general, Hot Pursuit or the old Burnout games, this is one of them. And it's been so long since there's been one of them. And I think that when you add on, there's a nice enough story here of, because a lot of people are bouncing off the dialogue, which I totally get. Like, I'm one of the people who hates Marvel-style dialogue. I hate constantly quippy BS. I think it gets in the way of stuff.
Dear, you've never mentioned that before.
I should probably bring it up more, to be honest. Maybe. It's a bit annoying. And if you really bounced off the Saints Row dialogue, that was Saints Row is an encapsulation of what not to do. Unbound is kind of like that in terms of like everything is lighthearted, everything's a quip. I quite like the story setup. I think that it has a quite a long, you don't even realize you're in the tutorial until you get a late title card and it's like, oh, so all of that was preparing us for this. Mm. And I quite like the reliance on the story. Like there's a whole thing about a rivalry that kind of happens and I really like what they do with that. It makes me care about a Need for Speed story in a way that I've never cared before. And I never played Need for Speed The Run, so I guess all the people who played The Run are just going like, no, that's the story Need for Speed game, which I totally get. But still, I care about the person that I made, like my character. I care about the general like layout of the world. I like the whole thing about how whatever happens in the tutorial, there's then like if there's a 3-year jump after that, and it's like, okay, because of what happened, street racing is now completely illegal. So the police clamp down on everything.
Yes.
And so street racing is even more illegal, but it's worth even more. And everyone's trying to get back out there. And there's this whole thing about a rivalry and whatever. I just think it's such a confident package. Like I said, it's like there's been a need for speed.
Very and good.
Arcade racing across the industry. And the likes of Dangerous Driving, which was made by ex-Burnout devs, didn't fill it. Like I liked Dangerous Driving, but it was like a carbon copy of Burnout 3.
Yeah.
Without like a lot of the punch of the takedowns. But it was enough. It was fine. But at the same time, when Criterion/EA remastered Burnout Paradise, that was in theory to test the waters for a new proper either Burnout game or arcade racer, and this is absolutely that game. And Need for Speed has not been this good in so long. Like,
what?
Heats and Payback sucked, and 2015's reboot was terrible.
Yeah.
So, like, this is great.
That's brilliant to hear. You've almost convinced me to get it. This year has been quite good for racing games, I think. You know, obviously, we've had the carryover from Forza Horizon 5 releasing at the end of last year, getting more content this year. We've had Gran Turismo 7, we've had Grid Legends, now we've had Need for Speed Unbound, and a lot of other smaller titles within those gaps. And it just feels like people are eating well if you're a racing fan.
Yeah, man.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And then that's the thing. I think there's a, like, for the longest time, it was like, well, Forza blew up, so let's just chase that stuff down. We'll do simulation type racing. Obviously, that came off Gran Turismo and whatever else as well. But for the longest time, there's just been a need for an arcade racer, something that just acknowledges that that used to be our whole market. Like, even like the old school Need for Speeds were like that. And so I like an open world map. You take the best of Burnout Paradise, an open world that's filled with like stunt ramps and things to collect and parts that, you know, like maybe you're hoovering up tags, like different parts of graffiti that you can then use as your part of your decal on your next car or something. It's just, it's a fun world to explore. The races are really cool. And the actual racing itself feels really, really tight and responsive. And you can also pause at any time and just tweak your car's handling a little bit.
Yeah.
So if you want to be more like Burnout, you can make the drifts huge. So you can slide right around everything, or you can tighten it up and make it a bit more simulation style. That also goes hand in hand with all the actual car tweaking stuff. So like, you know, one of the first things you have to do is get an A-grade car. So it's like, well, you could go out there and grind out the currency and buy an A-grade car, or you could put the time into building things up.
Yeah.
Get all the different exhaust parts and drivetrains and whatever, pulling two random car parts out. Because I don't know cars.
I have no idea where they are.
I don't know cars. I hover on the menu, and then if a number goes up, I buy that one. And yeah, then I go to the next one. And then make that like your A-grade car. And with, you know, alongside this incredible visual customization on the character side and on the car side, is just so, so delicious to drink in. Like, I have loved my time with Unbound.
That's amazing.
Absolutely loved every second of it so far. And the soundtrack is incredible as
Yo,
well.
Yo, I'm convinced. You have convinced
it's
me.
It's a lovely time.
That EA Big might be back, which is the best news that I've had perhaps all year.
Like, that's the thing. If they branded this as the return of EA Big, it would knock it out of the park. Like, they would, if this was the game that relaunched the EA Big franchise or branding, because I'm just thinking, do an SSX with this style. Like, why not? Like, you, like, character-wise, do cell shading or whatever you need to do and have sort of semi-realistic looking levels and have the whole game have this beat to it. Like,
yeah.
Just, yeah, there's so much more potential there that they could do. So I also saw that same headline about it not landing as well sales-wise, but I just hope people check this game out. If you love arcade racing, it's perfect.
Hopefully it has the legs. If it gets a good, you know, spread of word of mouth, if it's other people are enjoying it as much as you, hopefully it does have that longevity in it, and hopefully EA can finally decide on an identity for this franchise, because it's been going back and forward on a bunch of iterations for years now, and I don't want to come back in 2 years' time and see another Need for Speed game with another subtitle, with another art style, with another style of gameplay focus that just kind of comes and goes yet again.
That was the thing with this, was that when they first showed the trailer for it, only 2 or 3 months ago, it only really got announced like a few months ago, I loved that EA were taking such a risk with it. And I don't, you know, you shouldn't view a random cel-shaded art style as a risk, but it is to EA. And I imagine that a lot of the boardroom meetings they had to have to get this over the line, finish line, must have been a big deal, but I love that they still went for it. I was just, every second I'm playing it, I'm like, I love how much money was put into this.
Nice.
I love that that EA have backed this. And there's no, I mean, maybe there are microtransactions in it, but I've not noticed them. If there are, I think there probably are a way to pay your way through it somehow. But it's not remotely in your face, which it would have been really easy to do with the amount of customization that is in here. Speaking of microtransactions, Midnight Suns has them.
Tell me more.
I can't tell you that much. I've not interacted with them, but you can. There is a premium currency in that game, which is one of the only knocks against it. Hence it securing the second spot in the
right.
Three of the weekend.
Is that why? That's what we were talking about on the last week's pod. We were talking about the potential for this game.
What
but
a game.
The idea of it being monetized out the wazoo in terms of the cards and all of that jazz. Uh-huh. But outside of that, is it good? Because I've seen nothing but incredible reviews for this game. And on paper, it's a kind of inscription style deal where it's not my subgenre, but the quality of the reviews, the word of mouth that I've seen makes me think, maybe I'm a Midnight Suns fan. Maybe I need to buy that immediately.
I keep telling you, you've got a deck builder's heart.
I don't think that's true.
I think it is. You're the Grinch at Christmas. You just need to realize it's there. It's been there all along. Midnight Suns is a deck builder, is more of a deck builder than Inscription in terms of being aware of the cards that you're going to be playing going forward. But like, yeah, the fact that this is Firaxis, the fact that it's the XCOM devs for so long, and obviously XCOM Enemy Unknown when it came out, when it was rebooted or whatever in 2012, was such a moment for strategy fans, because it was like, oh my god, this is perfect. Like, this is what you give to anyone who cares about grid-based strategy. And I love that Firaxis, again, it's one of those games where you just sort of sit back and you're like, I'm so glad so much money was put into this. You know, obviously Firaxis being given their crack at a Marvel game,
yeah,
and then being like, we're not just going to do a turn-based strategy game. It's not just going to be like Transformers, that Devastate, whatever that one was that just came out, Rise of the Thingies. There was a turn-based, grid-based Transformers game.
I'll believe
you. It was terrible.
Okay.
I almost bought it because I love everything grid-based, and I didn't. But with this one, they were just like, what if we just ripped up the entire rule book? What if we didn't care about grid-based stuff? What if we didn't care about taking cover anymore? Mm-hmm. What if you just, you know, you still have your cards, you're still sort of like dulling the hand out, but you can burn them and replace the cards per hand, per turn. And what if we just got super inventive with all the different character abilities? Like, Ghost Rider can just create a portal to hell in the middle of any level, and then all your other characters can just throw people in it, like, as just part of your turn. And there's loads of environmental destruction stuff, like every enemy can be bounced off off someone else or bounced into the environment. You can chain loads of things together. It's very Mario and Rabbids. Mario and Rabbids is low-key super influential, if this is the case.
Yeah.
Because Mario and Rabbids was less about sticking to the per-turn structure and more how many things can you chain together per turn. And just like in Mario's case for the game, it's like, well, I'm going to run over here, I'm going to jump on my dude, I'm going to cross some distance, I'm going to land on another guy, then I'm going to take out two dudes, and then I'm going to plant something and do whatever, and that's my turn, as opposed to just I'm taking a shot and that's my turn.
Yeah.
So in this, it's all like that. It's all superhero combos and who works well with each other and everything else, mixed with just, or topped off by, unbelievably good animation.
Nice.
Like, just such punchy, really fun, weighty animation. Reminds me of Batman. You know when Batman just, like, folds a guy in half?
Hell
and
yeah.
He's like, oh, they're just in the hospital. Like, no, they're dead. Like, everyone's animation in this is just breaking people in half, slamming them through walls. Like, it's so satisfying.
Well, how does it work as a superhero game? Because every bit of discussion that I've seen on the title is how good of a deck builder it is, how good of a tactics game it is. But the fact that it is a Marvel game almost seems secondary. So how does it work with the kind of story? How are these characters implemented in terms of their narratives and characterization? Like, would this game be just as satisfying if it wasn't Marvel, or does Marvel give it the branding, give it an extra edge?
It definitely elevates it. This is a way better Marvel game than the Avengers was.
Nice.
Because one thing worth saying is that I didn't realize I could care about Marvel again. Like, the MCU is just like driven stuff into the floor. I just don't care. Like, the Phase 4 stuff, I'm just checked out.
I've never heard you say that before.
Again, I should talk about it more. But the story here is really, really cool. So it's like, you know, this whole thing where there's, I don't know, wider Marvel characters. Like, I didn't know Agatha Harkness.
That's right, yeah.
Until WandaVision. But I think there's a whole bunch of like wider witch stuff in Marvel that I just didn't know about at all. But there's a whole idea that this character called Lilith has been brought back, and then you sort of play as like her daughter.
Ooh.
So or father, I mean, or son rather. I'm playing as a woman, but you do whatever. And it's sort of like you're this ancient person who's battled her eons ago, called the Hunter, and you're brought back. You're resurrected by Doctor Strange and Nico, someone who I didn't know either. To fight this like ancient evil, and it's like, okay, she's mind controlling different characters. So one of the first bosses you go up against is like evil Venom,
but
you're also building your team. And then the whole superhero side of it is, like I said, it made me excited for Marvel because it made me excited to see what their version of X character is. And every time in my head, I was like, oh man, I've not met Spider-Man yet, and he's really cool. I've not met Wolverine yet; they're really cool. Their costumes are incredible. And knowing that you're going to get it, like the combat side of it, you know that you're going to get a series of characters that are, you immediately start thinking like, well, I bet Spidey can combo a bunch of things together. I bet he's going to be effective in this way that I'm already thinking of.
Yeah.
Because you have so many different like traversal options or whatever in combat. Like the first time I played as Ghost Rider, it flagged that he can grab like a lamppost or just like a big sort of like part of the environment and slam it down on two dudes because they're standing in a row. And so it starts making you think in that way, which you never thought of in XCOM. Like the idea that Captain Marvel has a photon beam that just damages everything in a row. It's like, well, let me line up all these dudes. Let me smash a toolkit off some dude's face so he stands in this place, and then I'll finish them off with Marvel, Captain Marvel. So it's that side of it. So yeah, in terms of the superhero thing, he plays this character called the Hunter who is new to the world, and they could have Draxed it. They could have easily Draxed it, which they kind of do. They do a couple of little lines about them just sort of saying, oh, what's the internet and whatever.
Right.
But they're so self-serious, and because it's like very BioWare style, you can make your dialogue choices very serious. You can say like, don't doubt me. Don't question me on this. Like, I know what I'm doing. I'm going to kill this person. And there's a whole like morality system in there, very Mass Effect style. Characters will remember this kind of thing. You also have different point totals based on who you're talking to, because if they're friendlier to you, they'll work better with you when you're out in combat. So you're encouraged to try and like, you know, make friends and everything. So that side of it, I think, is really, really good. I think it sort of ticks the box of like, what if you were inducted into this wider world of superheroes with a good power set? You feel like you're capable, but you're still encouraged to go talk to everybody and hang out. That's the side of it that people have bounced off, because
right.
It's very like, it's like what an X-Men game would have been like if you were like a new student and you're gonna go to the X-Mansion, and it's like, okay, do you want to go fishing with Wolverine? Do you want to hang
do,
out
you
with
know, I really do.
Part of me totally does. And so it's that whole thing of like, you know, you can spend time or more time around the academy, like becoming friends with everybody and doing all those things. I've just been doing whatever lets me prioritize the combat again, whatever gets me back out again, let me pick the next mission. That side of like Marvel representation of like making it exciting to meet your heroes, and then you think about the combat utility of them, I think they nail that stuff. Like, I've loved meeting everyone in this, and this, like I said, the animation is incredible. It looks so good, and because you have so much agency in the conversations that you're having, Having Blade in a game, I've missed him.
Oh,
where has Blade been?
Where has Blade been? Scott Telford, at the weekend, I bought the 4K version of Blade 1.
Did you?
This is what's making me think I want this game, because aesthetically, it looks right up my street. Yeah. And it's got all of the characters in there that I like, including some, like Blade, that you don't see in video games all the time. And it's, even though the gameplay itself might not be shouting out to me, the aesthetics in the characters absolutely are, man.
I think because you've done enough Inscription where you know what it means or what it feels like to play a card that will attack three opponents at once.
It's amazing to me.
Upgrade Blade's move so he can dart around the battlefield. That's another thing that they've just ripped up the rulebook on, is placement. It doesn't matter how far someone is away from you. You can run all the way over there and do a move and then pick up a whatever it is, some part of the environment, some piece of cement, and smash that into a dude, then run all the way over there and do something else. Blade's cards, when you upgrade them, let him glaive people and take life back,
nice,
or just take on like three dudes at once. Stuff like that is really, really satisfying.
Well, tell me more, because earlier on you said
I will try about, with this
you were talking about XCOM and how that's like the perfect game to give to people who are big tactics fans and who are new to this genre. Like, does Marvel Midnight Suns have the same sort of accessibility as someone who might feel a little bit intimidated by a deck builder, by a more tactics-oriented gameplay style?
Yeah, like, I would say so.
Does it ease you into it in that way and make it fun to play for a novice as much as it sounds fun for someone like yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I think because of how different the combat is, it's hard to like recommend it against anything else. Because if you were going to get into like the turn-based strategy genre, then you almost would want something to be more grid-based because that's more traditional. But at the same time, I really like, I mean, it's interesting that we've had like two games like this year.
Yeah.
Mario and Rabbids Sparks of Hope and this both do away with their grids. They both just give you radiuses that you can move within. And it's like, okay, like this frees everything up. You're still restricted a bit in Mario, but in this you can go wherever. Yeah, I think because they kind of have to sell a whole mainstream bunch of people on why this combat model is interesting and makes you think in different ways in terms of like analyzing like enemy patterns or whatever it is, they nail it. Like, I think that the way they play their cards, what's wrong with my head, is very, very effective. And I would just give this to anybody in terms of like maybe part of you is curious what a more turn-based game can be like, because I feel like turn-based stuff has such a bad rep. People just go, oh my god, it's turn-based, I've got to watch the animations instead of playing them. Oh, I'm done.
That's me.
It is you, but maybe it's less you now than it used to be.
I'm thinking
you've played through Inscription.
This is it. I'm thinking it might be, Scott, because Inscription was a good gateway, and Midnight Suns similarly seems like a good gateway drug. You know, yes. It gets me in with the Marvel characters. It gets me in with the kind of perhaps more forgiving framing, or certainly slightly innovative framing that's not as demanding as a proper grid-based tactics game. So maybe it has all of the ingredients to unlock a genre for me, which is what I like. I like getting a proper new genre just completely unlocked.
I think you would really like it. I think, and as well, because the animation is so satisfying. Like I said, on the character side, you are demolishing dudes. But at the same time, there are so many parts of the environment that don't count as a playing a card. But if you have hero points built up, different cards will give you hero points. You can burn them to just kick a couch at five guys or kick a part of the environment at someone. That, again, adds to your combo thing. And I think that makes it so satisfying, like, you know, as a way to tackle a bunch of dudes.
My big question is, Scott, you've got these three games. You've got Inscription yet to finish. How are you going to get through them all before Crisis Core, Final Fantasy VII, Reunion drops in, like, is that this week or next week? It's very soon.
16th, I think.
I want to say it's the 13th, but I could be wrong.
I could also add on Mario and Rabbids and Rogue Legacy 2 and Bayonetta 3, but
please don't add on that.
I just downloaded Fortnite and played that instead, because the Unreal Engine 5 is out now.
You are literally sick right now, but also figuratively sick.
Yeah.
How do you have the time?
I don't, to be honest. Very, very little gets focused on. But in terms of the current rollout, if they fix Callisto, that'll then be prioritized.
Okay.
Right now, I'm just tandeming between Need for Speed and Midnight Suns.
Have you put your Christmas decorations
up?
No.
What's that? What's Christmas? Who's this?
Video games is life. Video games is all.
Yeah. Can I get this 2 days early? But all three of those games have their positives. Midnight Suns and Need for Speed, absolutely way more as full packages. You can just give them to people. If you like Marvel, if you like arcade racing, dive in. You'll have an incredible time. Callisto is something that I'm just waiting on. I've already seen Glenn Schofield, the director, and Striking Distance Studios, like, tweeting, saying, we're getting there, we hear you, we'll fix it.
Do you know what's really funny?
Me trying to do this podcast with this throat.
That is quite funny, but what's even funnier is that, and I don't want to, again, I'm not ragging on this game, I just find it quite humorous as an observation, because it was so tacked on that Callisto was going to be good that when the Game Awards were announced, we were all thinking, well, this sucks.
Yeah.
The Callisto Protocol won't have the chance to compete. And now it's like, it never had the
maybe
chance
Jeff
to compete
knew.
By it.
Yeah, maybe Jeff knew. Always knew.
I just thought that was a funny thing because it was similar to Cyberpunk where it was like, oh, is Cyberpunk going to miss out? And it didn't matter because Cyberpunk absolutely crapped the bed and Callisto has done something very similar. Whereas now going forward, if a game misses or comes in right at the end of eligibility for the Game Awards, I'm going to be suspicious about it.
The thing is, like, they've got so much DLC and story stuff and whatever else planned for next year that it makes me, like, it's one of those things where it's like Callisto's game of 2023 because that's the actual launch because they've actually fixed the fundamentals. But I guess we'll see how it goes. You finished Inscription, though. We should end on the old Inscription. Maybe we'll do more stuff on it.
Yeah, we should do more stuff on it. But I finished that game, and what a bloody good surprise that was. We briefly talked about it in the Monday pod.
I think you're doing a video on it's the best game of 2022 that no one's played.
That's it.
Mainly because it came out last year on PC, and now it's on console.
That's the issue. We will get a lot. We will be slagged off for saying that it's a 2022 game because the
you
PC
slags, they'll say.
Players among us will be saying, don't be daft, it came out in 2021. But if you know anything about What Culture Gaming, it's that we ignore the PC release date.
Releases are all that matter.
And we only go off console releases because that's what most of us have. But Inscription as a game, incredible, man. Like, the twists in that title, to me, were just fascinating. Every single time I got to one, and I would argue there are three big gameplay shifts within that game, every single time one of those happened, I could not put it down. And I know you might not have necessarily the same opinion on those shifts that I do, but it was a game that constantly subverted my expectations in a good way and constantly gave me more than I ever anticipated. And I knew it was going to be good. This is with my expectations of knowing people love it and knowing it was going to be weird. And even with those expectations in mind, it was something really special. I don't know whether it'll get in my top five, but it'll certainly penetrate my top 10 of the year in some form.
There's something to be said about games that can still be mysterious in 2022.
Yeah.
And the way that this thing plays its hand is incredibly effective. And I think that I love the way that they kind of play threw you for a loop, because to not give anything away, Inscription is a card-based game where you're sort of like, you're basically just start the game and you're facing off against this weird entity that you can't see. It's a set of eyes in the dark and you're in a cabin. It's very spooky. It's very like, what the hell even am I? What's going on? Am I trapped here? Is this human? What the hell? And it's just like, and this thing just wants to play cards with you. To play a certain game with you, which is really cool. It's very Hand of Fate, but where Hand of Fate is more like third-person Arkham-style combat for the actual interactions when you play the cards, this is like a card game. It's more of like a Hearthstone thing. And I think the thing that made me bounce off initially was the tutorial was a little bit, okay, overcome this exact scenario with the exact cards you have. And all I wanted to do was like try different strategies. I wanted to build a deck and try different things. And you do get to do that over time. But the thing that's really incredible is that at any point you realize you can stand up and walk around the cabin.
Yeah.
And that's not an overarching thing for the game, but it is an indicator of what they capitalize on later, that is kind of just anything goes.
Yeah.
And there's basically three main acts. I'm at the very beginning of the final act now, but the places this game goes, the different game design elements that are in here, seven people will get this reference, but it's very Frog Fractions. Fractions 2, which you'll have to watch a video of Frog Fractions 2 when you get upstairs.
Okay.
This implies we're in a basement or something. But but still, games that can would be classed as subverting expectations, but games that have other games inside them or other mechanics inside them or other entire ideas that you would not even see coming,
yep,
I think are so worthwhile to recommend when they're done this well.
100%. That sense of mystery is absolutely its driving force. And, you know, like you said, from something as simple as realizing you can stand up and look around the area you're playing cards in and what is going on with this clock on the wall, what is going on with this locked safe, you know, it gives you all of these mysteries that you're holding in your head and trying to figure out as you play. I must admit, I similarly hit a roadblock with it that I fortunately overcame, because the roguelike genre in me don't get on, Scott.
Oh, dude, you're telling me.
Like, I feel like I break it every single time I play it, because with this game, like many roguelikes, like Hades, like Returnal, you know, you're getting fed parts of the mystery through failed runs. You're supposed to lose to get hints for the puzzles, and you need those puzzle items in this game to kind of progress the story. I didn't know that, because whilst I hit a roadblock earlier on, I'm going to do the humble brag thing that I did. I got stuck in the second area for 3 or 4 turns, and then I did the second area, the third boss, and the final boss all in one go. So I thought I'd completed the game in... On one hand, that was incredible, because it gave me one of my favorite gaming moments of the year when I beat the final boss in that run, because it was one of those situations where I don't mind rerunning things in roguelikes, but when I've done something the first time like that, and I kind of know I'm onto a really lucky run where I could just wrap it all up right there, the stakes are high, right? Because I'm going to have to relearn the second boss. I'm going to have to relearn right. the third area, and I've only had one pass through them. Mm. So I'm in this final area completely underpowered with a deck that I've built, and I'm incredibly focused on which cards I'm going to play. And just that kind of consideration. I don't play chess, but it was the closest thing to playing chess that I've ever experienced in video game form.
There's so many things, the amount of praise that you give an inscription, the conversations we've had as we've both been going through it, and the parts of the design that you're latching onto, you would love deck builders. You would love Midnight Suns or whatever. Something like that, a Hearthstone, a Magic the Gathering.
Maybe, but
the calls to you, my friend.
The issue is, this was so satisfying because it felt like an ending, because it felt like, I wasn't excited to beat the boss and then go through everything again just to be better. You know what I mean? It felt thrilling because it felt like I'd managed to play a really good hand all the way through these areas that should have killed me and wanted me dead, but I've managed to complete it, if that makes sense. Yeah, I don't know if other card builders have that same sense of finality, but the finality is what made that engaging to me, because when eventually, you know, no spoilers, but when you do beat that final boss, that's not the end of that section. No. You need to rerun it a few more times with certain items and whatnot. So when I had to go through for the second and third time, that's when I kind of thought, I actually wouldn't like deck builders maybe, because just the core gameplay isn't getting me. It's when there are stakes, it's when there's something on the line, and when I can finish a run to perfection or whatever it is.
No, there's definitely, I mean, it's. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there's a lot more game other than even the way you're playing for that that entity thing that you're fighting against for that. That's like let's just say it's the first third.
Yes.
There's a lot more going on in Inscription, which is why it's incredible. I'm in the, like I said, the back third where things have completely changed and I'm just like, okay, this is a whole other thing that I need to figure out. But yeah, that whole idea of like injecting narratives into roguelikes is definitely something that the likes of Hades was held up for doing incredibly well. But it's hilarious or fun or interesting or whatever that you can break it if you're good enough, because on the game design side they can't roadblock you too much, because then you might be too aware of it and say, well, I need to fail this encounter, and everyone hates those kind of encounters, so they're kind of relying on a certain level of like the average player or whatever, not, you know, bumping up against some sort of limit so they can give you a bit more story so that when you do finally break through it's way more satisfying, which I know is what broke Hades, because you were like, I just got all the way to the end and did it.
And it was the same here, and I was pleased I had some advice, because I was just kind of, you know, when you get onto a winning tactic or what you think is a winning tactic in a video game and it works once and then you just don't want to deviate from it because you know it works.
Yes.
This was what happened with me. After I beat that boss one time, I thought, well, I can do it. And the cards that I was unlocking, because you can get extra cards for your deck if you solve some of the puzzles around the cabin, like I didn't like them. They didn't make my deck any better. So I assumed that everything that you could get in the cabin was going to be supplementary and not integral to doing well. So I was rerunning this game with the core abilities that I had at the start. And while I got to the end boss one more time and got killed ultimately, I just was frustrated and lost, because I was thinking, well, what? I don't understand what the game wants me to do. I've beaten this boss once and I haven't really got close since. And I was like, what's, like, I didn't understand, because I'd won. I felt like I could win again, and that wasn't true. I needed to solve the puzzles in the cabin. And it was only talking with your friend of mine, Ash Millman, where I was saying, what does this game want from me? I don't understand what
I need to do.
Where Ash was like, she kind of pointed out and made me realize it was a me problem. She was saying, well, you know, if you're hitting a roadblock, have you solved the puzzles?
Yeah, now, what else has the game got available to you?
Exactly, what else has the game got available? And I said, no, I shouldn't need to solve the puzzles, because I'm good enough, I can get through it. And she was saying, Josh, If the game is giving you a roadblock...
You were Atreus.
Yeah, and it's throwing you up other content, check out that other content.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And once I got that advice through my thick skull, I managed to get progress in the game. So once I got over that roadblock, I thought the rest of the game was amazing. I just thought it was worth flagging that, because I think you and I both have different issues with roguelike structures. And with Returnal, with Hades, and with this, it's been a case of I felt like I've skipped content, and as a result, I've been kind of thrown off an otherwise expertly paced experience.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, like, that idea of pacing being contingent on player skill. And then, like, because I, like, I mean, for Inscription's case, I got right to the end of the first third boss, and then died in the very end, which broke all the narrative, because then the character stopped giving me the dialogue, and it just didn't work. And it's kind of the same thing with Hades. Once you've kind of hit credits on that, or the initial, like, time you escape or whatever, the game kind of just goes, like it just goes, whatever, like do whatever you want. And it's like, is it done? Like, have I beat this? And then, like, for me, that was the only knock against Hades, was that you kind of had to realize on your own accord that you need to beat it 9 more times.
Yeah.
So you have 10 in total, and then you get more scenes. And the dialogue changes, but I was just like, that didn't feel satisfying to me. But yeah, the idea of, like, story-based roguelikes where they're, like, fundamentally told in that way, I think is quite a new thing. That's why Hades was sort of held up. You should try Darkest Dungeon.
Yes.
I don't know if you've tried that.
I haven't, but it's always been on my radar, but I've never actually gotten around to it.
That's the game that a lot of people really struggle with. And there's not necessarily a character-driven story in that, but there's a lot of lore, and there's a lot of... It's just really, really well conceptualized. But a lot of people bounce off even the first couple of dungeons because it's so unforgiving. Yeah. But with you, you'll beat it straight away, and it'll be really fun.
I won't now. It'll be jinxed, but I just thought it was a... I thought this was a particularly funny experience because there's such a thrill. It's why I love and hate roguelikes, because there's a thrill of getting through something that you shouldn't be getting through at this point, and I love that feeling. And like you said there, the way that modern roguelikes especially integrate the story into the actual mechanics and the cyclical nature of those mechanics, I think, is just incredible at hiding mysteries. You know, say what you want about the gameplay of Returnal, Scott Tailford, but the fact that kept offering up, you know,
that was only good
twists
bit.
And variations on the story and the environments and the characters and the weapons, similar to how Hades achieved it through the dialogue with the gods or certain bosses who would repeat, but then also not really repeat because there may be new characters. Like, that element of it just keeps you wanting to get that one more run, you know, contextualize what you're doing, and I will love you forever. It's why, like I said, you know, why on paper a deck builder isn't for me, but when you contextualize it within this narrative in Inscription, where I know this is the final quote-unquote boss, I have stakes, that's when something is elevated for me, because the gameplay loop was good, but a reason to partake in that gameplay loop is even better.
I think Midnight Suns is definitely for you in that case. I think Darkest Dungeon is a really fun counter to how good you are at getting through stuff sometimes. I think the way that, like, games can serve up mechanics, you seem to be able to navigate that definitely better than I can. I think Darkest Dungeon will be an interesting challenge for you. Slay the Spire gets brought up a lot as, like, another sort of, like, card-based, like, injection of narrative game. But I've barely played Slay the Spire. I do have it downloaded, but I've barely done anything for that. But that might be another one to check out. I mean, anyone can get in touch and let us know what they think of various roguelikes with stories that have deck building mechanics in them, because that's an emerging market at some point. But yes, for now, this has been the wind up. We'll do a video on Inscription because I feel like it's one of the most recommendable games overall and just worth highlighting. We did a video last year, the best game of 2021 that no one played for, Pray for the Gods, which I absolutely love, like Shadow of the Colossus meets Breath of the Wild, and we'll try and do that for Inscription. For now, massive apologies for the state of my vocals. I'll have edited out most of the coughs, but there'll be some in there because I just couldn't keep them out. We'll keep them in. But yes, for now, this has been The Wind-Up. I've been Scott Tailford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tailford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree.
That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.